Let us now continue our preface on the treatise For the Love of God by St. Francis de Sales. In our age, also, many have written upon this subject, whose works I have not had leisure to read distinctly, but only here and there so far forth as was requisite to discover whether this book might yet find place. Father Louis of Granada, that great doctor of piety, has placed a treatise of the love of God in his memorial, which is sufficiently commended in saying it is his. Diego Stella, of the Order of St. Francis, made another, which is very effective and profitable for prayer. Christopher Fonseca, an Augustinian, brought out one still larger, wherein he has many excellent things. Father Louis Richomme of the Society has also published a book under the title of The Art of Loving God by His Creatures, and this author is so amiable in his person and in his beautiful writings that doubtless he is even more so in writing of love itself. Father John of Jesus Maria, a De Salzed Carmelite, has composed a little book, which is also called The Art of Loving God, and which is much esteemed. That great and celebrated Cardinal Bellarmine has also lately issued a little book entitled The Ladder for Ascending unto God by His Creatures, which cannot but be admirable, coming from that most learned hand and most devout soul, who has written so much and so wisely in the Church's behalf. I would say nothing of the paronetic of that river of eloquence who flows at present through all France in the multitude and variety of his sermons and noble writings. The close spiritual consanguinity which my soul has contracted with his, when by the imposition of my hands he received the sacred character of the Episcopal Order, to the great happiness of the Diocese of Belley and to the honor of the Church, besides 1,000 ties of a sincere friendship, which fasten us together, permits me not to speak with praise of his works, amongst which his Paranetic of Divine Love was one of the first sallies of the matchless wealth of intellect which everyone admires in him. We see further a goodly and magnificent palace, which the Right Reverend Father Lawrence of Paris, a Capuchin preacher, erected in honor of heavenly love, which being finished will be a complete course of the art of loving well. And lastly, the Blessed Mother, St. Teresa of Jesus, has written so accurately of the sacred movements of love in all the books she has left us, that one is amazed to see so much eloquence masked under such profound humility, such great solidity of wit in such great simplicity, and her most learned ignorance makes the knowledge of many learned men appear ignorant, who after long and laborious study have to blush at not understanding what she so happily puts down touching the practice of holy love. Thus does God raise the throne of his power upon the ground of our infirmity, making use of weak things to confound the strong. And although, my dear reader, this treatise which I now present you comes far short of those excellent works, without hope of ever running even with them, yet have I such confidence in the favor of the two heavenly lovers to whom I dedicate it, that still it may be in some way serviceable to you, and that in it you will meet with many wholesome considerations, which you would not elsewhere so easily find, as again you may elsewhere find many beautiful things which are not here. Indeed, it even seems to me that my design is not the same as that of others, except in general, inasmuch as we all look towards the glory of holy love. But this you will see by reading it. Truly my intention is only to represent simply and naively, without art, still more without false colors, the history of the birth, progress, decay, operations, properties, advantages, and excellences of divine love. And if besides this you find other things, these are but excrescences which it is almost impossible for such as me, who write amidst many distractions, to avoid. But still, I think that there will be nothing without some utility. Nature herself, who is so skillful a workwoman, intending to produce grapes, produces at the same time, as by a prudent inadvertence, such an abundance of leaves and branches, that there are very few vines which have not in their season to be pruned of leaves and shoots. Writers are often treated too harshly. The censures that are passed on them are given hastily, and very often with more incorrectness than they committed imprudence in hastening to publish their writings. Precipitation of judgment greatly puts in danger the conscience of the judge and the innocence of the accused. Many write amiss and many censure foolishly. The kindness of the reader makes his reading sweet and profitable. And, my dear reader, to have you more favorable, I will here give you an explanation of some points which might peradventure otherwise put you out of humor. Some perhaps will think that I have said too much, and that it was not requisite to go so deep down into the roots of the subject, but I am of the opinion that heavenly love is a plant like to that which we call angelica, whose root is no less odoriferous and wholesome than the stalk and the branches. The four first books and some chapters of the rest might without doubt have been omitted, without disadvantage to such souls as only seek the practice of holy love. Yet all of it will be profitable unto them if they behold it with a devout eye. While others also might have been disappointed not to have had the whole of what belongs to the treatise of divine love. I have taken into consideration, as I should do, the state of minds of this age. It much imports to remember in what age we are writing. I cite scripture sometimes in other terms than those of the ordinary edition, the Vulgate. For God's sake, my dear reader, do me not therefore the wrong to think that I wish to depart from that edition. Ah, no, for I know the Holy Ghost has authorized it by the Sacred Council of Trent, and that therefore all of us ought to keep to it. On the contrary, I only use the other versions for the service of this when they explain and confirm its true sense. For example, what the heavenly spouse says to his spouse, "Thou hast wounded my heart," is greatly illustrated by the other version, "Thou hast taken away my heart," or "Thou hast snatched away and ravished my heart." That which our Savior said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit," is much amplified and cleared by the Greek, "Blessed are the beggars in spirit," and so with others. I have often cited the sacred psalmist in verse, and this to recreate your mind and on account of the ease with which I could do it by the beautiful translation of Philip de Port, Abbot of Tyrone. This, however, I have sometimes departed from, not of course thinking I could improve the verses of this famous poet, for I should be too impertinent if, never having so much as thought of this kind of writing, I should pretend to be happy in it in an age and condition of life which would oblige me to retire from it in case I had ever been engaged therein. But in some places, where the sense might be variously taken, I have not followed his verse, because I would not follow his sense. Where he has taken a certain Latin word for the fringe of the garment, which I thought ought to be taken for the collar, wherefore I have translated it to my own mind. I have said nothing which I have not learned of others, yet it is impossible for me to remember whence I had everything in particular. But believe me, if I had taken any lengthy and remarkable passages out of any author, I would make it a matter of conscience not to let him have the deserved honor of it, and to remove a suspicion which you may conceive against my sincerity in this matter. I warn you that the 13th chapter of Book 7 is extracted from a sermon which I delivered at Paris, at St. John's, upon the feast of the Assumption of Our Blessed Lady, 1602. I have not always expressed the sequence of the chapters, but if you notice, you will easily find the links of their connection. In that and several other things, I had a care to spare my own leisure and your patience. After I had caused the Introduction to a Devout Life to be printed, my Lord Archbishop of Vienne, Peter de Villiers, did me the favor of writing his opinion of it, in terms so advantageous to that little book and to me, that I should never dare to rehearse them, and exhorting me to apply the most of my leisure to the like works, amongst many rare counsels he favored me with, one was that as far as the matter would permit, I should always be short in the chapters. For as, said he, travelers, knowing that there is a fair garden some 20 or 25 paces out of their way, readily turn aside so short a distance to go see it, which they would not do if it were further distant. Even so, those who know that there is but little distance between the beginning and the end of a chapter do willingly undertake to read it, which they would not do though the subject were never so delightful if a long time were required for the reading of it. And therefore, I had good reason to follow my own inclination in this respect, since it was agreeable to his great personage, who was one of the most saintly prelates and learned doctors that the church has had in our age, and who at the time that he honored me with his letter was the most ancient of all the doctors of the faculty of Paris. A great servant of God informed me not long ago that by addressing my speech to Philothea in the introduction to A Devout Life, I hindered many men from profiting by it, because they did not esteem advice given to a woman to be worthy of a man. I marvel that there were men who, to be thought men, showed themselves in effect so little men, for I leave it to your consideration, my dear reader, whether devotion be not as well for men as for women, and whether we are not to read with as great attention and reverence the second epistle of St. John, which was addressed to the Holy Lady Electa, as the third which he directs to Caius, and whether 1,000,000 epistles and excellent treatises of the ancient fathers of the church ought to be held unprofitable to men because they are addressed to holy women of those times. But besides, it is the soul which aspires to devotion that I call Philothea, and men have souls as well as women. Nevertheless, to imitate the great apostle in this occasion, who esteemed himself a debtor to everyone, I have changed my address in this treatise and speak to Theotimus. But if perchance there should be any women, and such an unreasonableness would be more tolerable in them, who would not read the instructions which are given to men, I beg them to know that Theotimus, to whom I speak, is the human spirit, desirous of making progress in holy love, which spirit is equally in women as in men. This treatise, then, is made for a soul already devout, that she may be able to advance in her design, and hence I have been forced to say many things somewhat unknown to the generality, and which will therefore appear more obscure than they are. The depths of science are always somewhat hard to sound, and there are few diverse who care and are able to descend and gather the pearls and other precious stones which are in the womb of the ocean. But if you have the courage fairly to penetrate these words which I have written, it will truly be with you as with the diverse who say, "Pliny, see clearly in the deepest caves of the sea the light of the sun, for you will find in the hardest parts of this discourse a good and fair light." Moreover, as I do not follow them that despise books treating of a certain supereminently perfect life, so for my part, I do not speak of such a supereminence, for I can neither censure the authors nor authorize the censors of a doctrine which I do not understand. I have touched on a number of theological questions, proposing simply not so much what I anciently learned in disputations as what attention to the service of souls and my 24 years spent in holy preaching have made me think most conducive to the glory of the gospel and of the church. For the rest, some men of note in various places have signified to me that certain little books have been published simply under the first letters of their author's name, which are the same as mine. This made some believe that they were my works, not without some little scandal, to such as supposed thereby that I had bidden adieu to my simplicity to puff up my style with pompous words, my argument with worldly conceit, and my conceptions with a lofty and plumed eloquence. For this cause, my dear reader, I will tell you that as those who engrave or cut precious stones, having their sight tired by keeping it continually fixed upon the small lines of their work, are glad to keep before them some fair emerald, that by beholding it from time to time they may be recreated with its greenness and restore their weakened sight to its natural condition, so in this press of business which my office daily draws upon me, I have ever little projects of some treatise of piety, which I look at when I can, to revive and unweary my mind. However, I do not profess myself a writer, for the dullness of my spirit and the condition of my life, subject to the service and requirements of many, would not permit me so to be. Wherefore I have written very little, and have published much less, and following the counsel and will of my friends, I will tell you what I have written, that you may not attribute the praises of another's labors to him who deserves none for his own. It is now 19 years since that, being at Thonon, a small town situated upon the Lake of Geneva, which was then being little by little converted to the Catholic faith, the minister, an adversary of the Church, was proclaiming everywhere that the Catholic article of the real presence of our Savior's body in the Eucharist destroyed the symbol and the analogy of faith, for he was glad to mouth this word analogy not understood by his auditors, in order to appear very learned, and upon this the rest of the Catholic preachers with whom I was pressed me to write something in refutation of this vanity. I did what seemed suitable, framing a brief meditation upon the creed to confirm the truth. All the copies were distributed in this diocese, where now I find not one of them. Soon afterwards, His Highness came over the mountains, and finding the bailiwicks of Chablis, Gaillard, and Tournier, which are in the environs of Geneva, well disposed to receive the Catholic faith, which had been banished thence by force of wars and revolts about 70 years before, he resolved to re-establish the exercise thereof in all the parishes, and to abolish that of heresy. And whereas on the one side there were many obstacles to this great blessing from those considerations which are called reasons of state, and on the other side some persons as yet not well instructed in the truth made resistance against this so much desired establishment, His Highness surmounted the first difficulty by the invincible constancy of his zeal for the Catholic religion, and the second by an extraordinary gentleness and prudence. For he had the chief and most obstinate called together, and made a speech unto them with so loving a persuasive an eloquence, that almost all, vanquished by the sweet violence of his fatherly love towards them, cast the weapons of their obstinacy at his feet, and their souls into the hands of Holy Church. And allow me, my dear reader, I pray you, to say this word in passing. One may praise many rich actions of this great prince, in which I see the proof of his valor and military knowledge, which with just cause is admired throughout all Europe. But for my part, I cannot sufficiently extol the re-establishment of the Catholic religion in these three bailiwicks, which I have just mentioned, having seen it in so many marks of piety, united with so many and various acts of prudence, constancy, magnanimity, justice, and mildness, that I seem to see in this one little trait, as in a miniature, all that is praised in princes who have in times past, with most fervor, striven to advance the glory of God and the Church. The stage was small, but the action great. And as that ancient craftsman was never so much esteemed for his great pieces as he was admired for making a ship of ivory fitted with all its gear in so tiny a volume that the wings of a bee covered all, so I esteem more that which this great prince did at that time in this small corner of his dominions than many more brilliant actions which others extol to the heavens. Now on this occasion, the victorious ensigns of the cross were replanted in all the ways and public places of those quarters, And whereas a little before there had been one erected very solemnly, close to Geneva, a certain minister made a little treatise against the honor thereof, which was a burning and venomous invective, and to which therefore it was deemed fit to make answer. My Lord Claude de Grignier, my predecessor, whose memory is in benediction, imposed the burden upon me according to the power which he had over me, who beheld him not only as my bishop, but also as a holy servant of God. I made therefore this answer, under the title Defense of the Standard of the Cross, and dedicated it to His Highness, partly to testify unto him my most humble submission, and partly to render him some small thanksgiving for the care which he took of the church in those parts. Now lately, this defense has been reprinted under the prodigious title of Panthology, or Treasure of the Cross, a title whereof I never dreamed, as in truth I am not a man of that study and leisure, nor of that memory, to be able to put together so many pieces of worth in one book, as to let it deserve the name of treasure or panthology. Besides, I have a horror of such insolent frontispieces. A sot or senseless creature we call him call, who makes his portal greater than his hall. In the year 1602 were celebrated at Paris, where I was, the obsequies of that magnanimous prince Philip Emmanuel of Lorraine, Duke of Mercure, who had performed so many brave exploits against the Turks in Hungary that all Christianity was bound to conspire to honor his memory. But especially, Madame Mary of Luxembourg, his widow, did for her part all that her heart and the love of the deceased could suggest to her to make his funeral solemn. And because my father, grandfather, and great-grandfather had been brought up pages to the most illustrious princes of Martigues, her father and his predecessors, she regarded me as an hereditary servant of her house, and made choice of me to preach the funeral sermon in that great celebration, where there were not only several cardinals and prelates, but a number of princes also, princesses, marshals of France, knights of the order, and even the court of parliament in a body. I made then this funeral oration and pronounced it in this great assembly in the great church of Paris, and as it contained a true abridgment of the heroic feats of the deceased prince, I willingly had it printed at the request of the widow princess, whose request was to me a law. I dedicated this piece to Madame the Duchess of Vendôme, as yet a girl, and a very young princess, yet one in whom were very clearly to be recognized the signs of that excellent virtue and piety which now adorn her, and which show her to be worthy of the bringing forth and educating by so devout and pious a mother. While this sermon was in the press, I heard that I had been made bishop, so that I came here to be consecrated and to begin residence. And at first, there was pointed out to me the necessity of instructing confessors on some important points. For this reason, I wrote 25 instructions, which I had printed to get them more easily spread amongst those to whom I directed them. Since then, they have been reprinted in various places. 3 or 4 years afterwards, I published the Introduction to a Devout Life, upon the occasion and in the manner which I have put down in the preface thereof, regarding which I have nothing to say to you, my dear reader, save only that though this little book has generally had a gracious and kind acceptance, yes, even among the most grave prelates and doctors of the church, yet it did not escape the rude censure of some who did not merely blame me, but bitterly attacked me in public, because I tell Philothea that dancing is an action indifferent in itself, and that for recreation's sake one may make quod libet, and I, knowing the equality of these censures, praise their intention, which I think was good. I should have desired them, however, to please to consider that the first proposition is drawn from the common and true doctrine of the most holy and learned divines, that I was writing for such as live in the world and in courts, that withal I carefully inculcate the extreme dangers which are found in dancing, and that as to the second proposition, it is not mine, but St. Louis's, that admirable king, a doctor worthy to be followed in the art of rightly conducting courtiers in a devout life. For I believe, if they had weighed this, their charity and discretion would never have permitted their zeal, how vigorous and austere soever, to arm their indignation against me. And therefore, my dear reader, I conjure you to be gracious and good to me in reading this treatise. And if you find this style a little, though I am sure it will be but a very little different from that which I used in the defense of the cross, know that in 19 years one learns and unlearns many things, that the language of war differs from that of peace, and that a man uses one manner of speech to young apprentices and another to old fellow craftsmen. My purpose here is to speak to souls that are advanced in devotion, for you must know that we have in this town a congregation of maidens and widows who, having retired from the world, live with one mind in God's service, under the protection of His Most Holy Mother, and as their purity and piety of spirit have oftentimes given me great consolation, so have I striven to return them the like by a frequent distribution of the Holy Word, which I have announced to them as well as in public sermons as in spiritual conferences, and this almost always in the presence of some religious men and people of great piety. Hence, I have often had to treat of the most delicate sentiments of piety, passing beyond that which I had said to Philothea, and I owe a good part of that which I now communicate to you to this blessed society, because she, who is the mother of them and rules them, knowing that I was writing upon this subject, and yet that scarcely was I able to accomplish it without God's very special assistance and their continual urging, took a constant care to pray and get prayers for this end, and holily conjured me to pick out all the little morsels of leisure which she judged might be spared here and there from the press of my hindrances, and to employ them in this. And because this soul is in that consideration with me, which God knows she's had no little power to animate me in this occasion, I began indeed long ago to think of writing on holy love, but that thought came far short of what this occasion has made me produce, an occasion which I declare to you thus simply and in good faith, in imitation of the ancients, that you may know that I write only as I get the chance and opportunity, and that I may find you more favorable. It is said amongst the pagans that Phidias never represented anything so perfectly as the gods, nor Apelles as Alexander. One is not always equally successful. If I fall short in this treatise, let your goodness make progress, and God will bless your reading. To this end, I have dedicated this work to the Mother of Delection and to the Father of Cordial Love, as I dedicated the introduction to the Divine Child, who is the Savior of lovers and the love of the saved. And as women, while they are strong and able to bring forth their children with ease, choose commonly their worldly friends to be godfathers, but when their feebleness and indisposition make their delivery hard and dangerous, invoke the saints of heaven, and vow to have their children stood to by some poor body or some devout soul in the name of St. Joseph, St. Francis of Assisi, St. Francis of Paula, St. Nicholas, or some other of the blessed, who may obtain of God their safe delivery, and that the child may be born alive. So I, while I was not yet bishop, having more leisure and less fears for my writings, dedicated my little works to princes of the earth. But now, being weighed down with my charge, and having 1,000 difficulties in writing, I consecrate all to the princes of heaven, that they may obtain for me the light requisite, and that, if such be the divine will, these my writings may be fruitful and profitable to many. Thus, my dear reader, I beseech God to bless you and to enrich you with His love. Meanwhile, from my very heart, I submit all my writings, my words, and actions to to the correction of the Most Holy Catholic, Apostolic, and Roman Church, knowing that she is the pillar and ground of truth, wherein she can neither be deceived nor deceive us, and that none can have God for his Father who will not have this Church for his Mother. At Annecy, the day of the most loving apostles, St. Peter and St. Paul, 1616. Blessed be God. We now begin The Love of God, Book 1, containing a preparation for the whole treatise. Chapter 1. That for the beauty of human nature, God has given the government of all the faculties of the soul to the will. Union in distinction makes order. Order produces agreement, and proportion and agreement in complete and finished things make beauty. An army has beauty when it is composed of parts so arranged in order that their distinction is reduced to that proportion which they ought to have together for the making of one single army. For music to be beautiful, the voices must not only be true, clear, and distinct from one another, but also united together in such a way that there may arise a just consonance and harmony, which is not unfitly termed a discordant harmony, or rather harmonious discord. Now as the angelic St. Thomas, following the great St. Denis, says excellently well, beauty and goodness, though in some things they agree, yet still are not one and the same thing. For good is that which pleases the appetite and will, beauty that which pleases the understanding or knowledge, or in other words, good is that which gives pleasure when we enjoy it, beauty that which gives pleasure when we know it. For which cause, in proper speech, we only attribute corporal beauty to the objects of those two senses, which are the most intellectual and most in the service of the understanding, namely, sight and hearing, so that we do not say these are beautiful odors or beautiful tastes, but we rightly say these are beautiful voices and beautiful colors. The beautiful, then, being called beautiful because the knowledge thereof gives pleasure, it is requisite that besides the union and the distinction, the integrity, the order, and the agreement of its parts, there should be also splendor and brightness that it may be knowable and visible. Voices, to be beautiful, must be clear and true, discourses intelligible, colors brilliant and shining. Obscurity, shade, and darkness are ugly and disfigure all things, because in them nothing is knowable, neither order, distinction, union, nor agreement, which caused St. Denis to say that God, as the sovereign beauty, is author of the beautiful harmony, beautiful luster, and good grace which is found in all things, making the distribution and decomposition of his one ray of beauty spread out as light to make all things beautiful, willing that to compose beauty there should be agreement, clearness, and good grace. Certainly, Theotimus, beauty is without effect, unprofitable and dead, if light and splendor do not make it lively and effective, whence we term colors lively when they have light and luster. But as to animated and living things, their beauty is not complete without good grace, which besides the agreement of perfect parts, which makes beauty, adds the harmony of movements, gestures, and actions, which is, as it were, the life and soul of the beauty of living things. Thus, in the sovereign beauty of our God, we acknowledge union, yea, unity of essence and the distinction of persons, with an infinite glory, together with an incomprehensible harmony of all perfections of actions and motions, sovereignly comprised, and as one would say, excellently joined and adjusted, in the most unique and simple perfection of the pure divine act, which is God himself, immutable and invariable, as elsewhere we shall show. God, therefore, having a will to make all things good and beautiful, reduced the multitude and distinction of the same to a perfect unity, and, as man would say, brought them all under a monarchy, making a subordination of one thing to another, and of all things to himself, the sovereign monarch. He reduces all our members into our one body, under one head. Of many persons he forms a family, of many families a town, of many towns a province, of many provinces a kingdom, putting the whole kingdom under the government of one sole king. So, Theotimus, over the innumerable multitude and variety of actions, motions, feelings, inclinations, habits, passions, faculties, and powers which are in man, God has established a natural monarchy in the will, which rules and commands all that is found in this little world. And God seems to have said to the will, as Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Thou shalt be over my house, and at the commandment of thy mouth all the people shall obey." This dominion of the will is exercised indeed in various ways. Chapter 2. How the will variously governs the powers of the soul. A father directs his wife, his children, and his servants by his ordinances and commandments, which they are obliged to obey, though they are able not to obey. But if he have servants and slaves, he rules them by force, which they have no power to contradict. His horses, oxen, and mules he manages by industry, binding, bridling, goading, shutting in, or letting out. Now the will governs the faculty of our exterior motion as a serf or slave, for unless some external thing hinder, it never fails to obey. We open and shut our mouth, move our tongue, our hands, feet, eyes, and all the members to which the power of this movement refers, without resistance, according to our wish and will. But as for our senses and the faculties of nourishing, growing, and producing, we cannot with the same ease govern them, but we must employ industry and art. If a slave be called, he comes. If he be told to stop, he stops. But we must not expect this obedience from a sparrowhawk or a falcon. He that desires it should return to the hand must show it the lure. If he would keep it quiet, he must hood it. We bid our servant turn to the right or left hand, and he does it. But to make a horse so turn, we must make use of the bridle. We must not, Theotimus, command our eyes not to see, our ears not to hear, our hands not to touch, our stomach not to digest, or our body not to grow. For these faculties, not having intelligence, are not capable of obedience. No one can add a cubit to his stature. We often eat without nourishing ourselves or growing. He that will prevail with these powers must use industry. A physician who has to do with a child in the cradle commands him nothing, but only gives orders to the nurse to do such and such things. Or else, perchance, he prescribes for the nurse to eat this or that meat, to take such and such medicine. This infuses its qualities into the milk which enters the child's body, and the physician accomplishes his will in this little weakling who has not even the power to think of it. We must not give the orders of abstinence, sobriety, or continency unto the palate or stomach, but the hands must be commanded only to furnish to the mouth meat and drink in such and such a measure we take away from or give our faculties their subject and object, and the food which strengthens them as reason requires. If we desire our eyes not to see, we must turn them away, or cover them with their natural hood and shut them, and by these means we may bring them to the point which the will desires. It would be folly to command a horse not to wax fat, not to grow, not to kick. To effect all this, stop his corn. You must not command him, you must simply make him do as you wish. The will also exercises a certain power over the understanding and memory. For of many things which the understanding has power to understand, and the memory has power to remember, the will determines those to which she would have her faculties apply themselves, or from which divert themselves. It is true, she cannot manage or range them so absolutely as she does the hands, feet, or tongue, on account of the sensitive faculties, especially the fancy, which do not obey the will with a prompt and infallible obedience, and which are necessarily required for the operations of the understanding and memory, but yet the will moves, employs, and applies these faculties at her pleasure, though not so firmly and constantly that the light and variable fancy does not often divert and distract them, so that as the apostle cries out, I do not the good which I desire, but the evil which I hate. So we are often forced to complain that we think not of the good which we love, but the evil which we hate. Let us continue The Love of God on Side B, following a short interlude of music.